Shoes off, belt off, 3.4 ounces of liquid. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you're in the Lake Washington District, welcome back to school. But if you're in Seattle, welcome to spring break and welcome to airport security lines. Nearly 1,000 passengers missed flights last month at SeaTac Airport because they were stuck waiting in line at security. Lines have taken even longer than usual in recent months. Some travelers stood in line for 2 hours, and we haven't even reached the busiest part of the year, which would be summertime. So I went to the man in charge of SeaTac, Lance Little, and asked him what's going on. He said the problem starts with growth.
SeaTac Airport is the fastest growing large hub airport in the United States. So we've just had tremendous growth here at the airport. And one of the challenges here now is do we have the TSA staff or the additional TSA staff that is required to keep pace with this growth?
Are you saying this is just a matter of the federal government sending more TSA agents to SeaTac Airport?
That would be a big part of the solution.
And well, what stops them from doing that? Can't you say, here's budget. Our lines?
Well, budget. They have a budget, budget restrictions, and you know, that's one of the concerns. This is not just for SeaTac Airport. This is for all the airports around the USA. They have a finite budget that has been allocated, and unless that cap is lifted, and they get additional, additional staff, and it's going to be a challenge for growing airports such as ours and other airports in the USA.
Okay. Meanwhile, what can SeaTac Airport do besides wait for federal people and dogs?
No, we're not waiting. So one of the things we're doing for the peak period, which is between May and September, we're actually bringing on interim workers. We're going to be bringing in approximately 90 workers. And over the May to September period, and they're going to be assisting with their non-screening tasks, such as divesting, such as queue management, such as bin return.
Divesting and queue management? What does all that mean?
So when divesting, you know, take your shoe off, take your belt off, managing the queue, bin return, returning the bins, etc.
Uh-huh.
If we can take on some of those functions in the interim, right, and this is an interim measure. If we can take on some of those measures during the interim, then the TSA officer would be freed up to do screening and x-raying, which is where you really add value, which is where you get the lines really moving.
What our listener cares about is any of this going to get me through security faster? What can you tell flyers?
It definitely will. Once we get the additional staff in place, and we've tested it. We tested it last Thursday and Friday, which was two busiest days we have had this year, and it worked very well. So we have tested it, and we know it will work. We just need to be able to get the staff in. Again, we're going to, in the interim, bring this additional interim staff on board to help, again, with, I said, queue management, with divesting, with bin return, with exit control, exit lane control. And once we do that, you'll see a significant difference at the airport.
SeaTac is growing so fast. Are we just going to outgrow any solutions?
I'm not sure if we're going to outgrow the solution, but it's actually a good reflection on the region. If you have that type of growth at the airport, it means the region is growing and the region is booming, and we don't want to be the bottleneck to the growth within the region. So that's one of the reasons we have to make sure we have a solution, working again closely with the TSA agency here to make sure we have a solution to this problem.
What can travelers do while the lines are long?
So travelers can, we'd encourage more travelers to sign up for pre-check. That's a big plus. But also one of the big issues, if you observe the security checkpoint lines, the big holdup is actually X-raying bags. And so if travelers could take laptops out of your bag, if you could take the gels and the liquids out of your bag, it makes a big difference in terms of how fast the line moves. Also, if you're in a line and the dogs are running the line, don't stop, don't pet the dog, just move through as if the dog is not there. It helps to also move the lines through a whole lot faster as well.
Meanwhile, show up 2 hours before a flight and don't pet the dogs?
Don't pet the dogs, don't stop, just keep moving, yes.
The dogs are working. That's Port of Seattle Aviation Division Managing Director Lance Little. One more tip if you hate long security lines, travel in the middle of the day. This is KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. It's 12:11. What is wrong at Western State? This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Governor Jay Inslee is calling for swift action after two men briefly escaped out a window at Western State Hospital last week. Police captured both men after a statewide manhunt. The escapes are the latest incidents to raise concerns over the safety of patients and workers at Western. Associated Press reporter Martha Belisle has been covering Western State Hospital. She told me why Western has been struggling.
Well, the state says that it's happening in large part because they have not been able to hire and retain enough staff. They've got a lot of patients. It's an 800-bed facility. It's the largest in the state of Washington, and they just don't have enough people to, you know, to oversee them.
And why don't they have enough people?
Well, the state claims it's because they haven't been able to pay wages that, you know, really will draw people in. And some staff say they have concerns about safety and mismanagement, and so it depends on who you talk to, really.
The federal government has been investigating Western State Hospital because of a violent attack on a worker, a patient-on-patient sexual assault. What does the federal government expect to change at Western?
Well, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid started investigating and issuing warnings against Western State Hospital last year. They issued four termination notices saying, unless you fix the problems there, we're going to cut your federal funds. It's millions of dollars worth of funding. And they sent inspectors in. They found safety problems. They found they investigated attacks or assaults, and they found problems also with, you know, medication and with infection control. And so over time, the state would come back and say, here's our plan of correction. We're going to do these things. And the feds would come back in, and they would check to see if that was done. And then they'd issue another notice. So the latest notice was supposed to go into effect. You know, their deadline was April 1st, but the federal agency extended that until May 3rd. So right now, the state is trying to fix the latest problems, and they've sent in their plan of correction and are trying to remedy those, and the federal government will come back in and the regulators, and they'll decide whether those fixes were adequate.
What would happen to the hospital?
I don't think they've gotten that far. I mean, they've got more people coming in. You know, they get people from a variety of ways. They get people who are found not guilty by reason of insanity, or they get people who are been found incompetent and they get treatment to have their competency restored. They get people who are found to be a danger to themselves or others. So there are a variety of people, but they all clearly need to be institutionalized for some reason. So I don't know where those people would go if they didn't have enough funds to run the facility fully.
Martha, you've reported on Western State before. What are the biggest questions you've got about safety and security of the hospital?
Well, I continue to hear from people who are working on the inside that they fear for their own safety, and they are concerned that management has not been adequate to really ensure that everybody's safe there. So I guess that's my biggest concern, is how are we going to stop the assaults? I mean, to hear, as I reported over the weekend, there was, you know, a new internal kind of investigation on safety that found a number of problems. And then there were also these new reports of a patient claiming that another patient raped him in a bathroom. There was an assault on a staff member, and that staffer had to go to the hospital. So with all the efforts to fix the problems, these kinds of assaults continue to happen.
A couple of minutes ago, you told us that it was a problem of hiring, retaining staff, and wages, but you're talking about accusations of management problems and safety lapses. So which do you think is more true?
Well, I think it could all be true. They don't have enough staff, and maybe they're not moving the staff around adequately. I know that a lot of people, because they have staffing problems, management has required a lot of overtime. Sometimes they also, one complaint I've heard is that management will bring in people to work certain shifts at certain times. And so the people who come in to work for a day or two and then leave don't know the patients, don't know the environment. And with some of these patients, it's really important to kind of know how to de-escalate them, how to calm them down, what things work and what things don't. And so you really need a lot of consistency. And so it's if they could hire enough people to have them have the same people working with the same patients over and over, it would help to calm things down.
You know, Martha, Western State is a place where we lock people and we lock our problems away. Why should listeners care about what happens at Western State Hospital?
Well, there are people who are there for a variety of reasons, and I mean, it's not a correctional facility. It's not a prison. Some people are there because they have gone through a period where they're having a mental health crisis and they're a danger. They are in danger of hurting themselves or other people. And so if you have a family member who is in that sort of crisis, you want to have the assurance that they're going to be placed in a place where they're safe. And just, you know, as a society, we want to be taking care of people who are having mental health issues. It's not something that we just lock them away and forget about them. They're part of society. They're vulnerable. They're in need, and it's part of part of the state's obligation to its citizens to take care of these people.
That's Associated Press reporter Martha Belisle covering problems at Western State Hospital in Pierce County. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have repeatedly cited that facility over safety concerns and threatened to cut millions of dollars in federal funding. We'll keep following the story on KUOW Seattle. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A few years ago, Delaney Rustin's 12-year-old daughter, Tessa, said she wanted a smartphone. Tessa already had a flip phone. She wanted something newer and cooler. Rustin wanted to know what boundaries to set around smartphone use, and she wanted to know how parents get their teenagers to respect those boundaries. And her search for answers turned into a documentary called Screenagers. I asked her, isn't making a documentary sort of an extreme way to answer a parenting question?
Well, I've been making documentaries for a long time, actually about mental health issues. And I started recognizing that we were having mental health issues in our house with a lot of tension and anxiety around my daughter, who wanted more and more social media, and my son, who wanted more video games. And as a doctor, I was thinking about the impact of all this screen time on kids everywhere. So I decided to start making a film about it, and in particular to start looking for solutions of helping kids find balance.
You're a doctor yourself, mm-hmm. So you know everything, right? Like you've got, you're smarty pants
yes.
parent.
Oh, right. I know everything. Are you kidding? I was struggling as much as any parent I have met, if not more.
What did you learn about gadgets and kids that you didn't know?
Oh, all of this I didn't know. Before, I was feeling, when I started this film project and as a parent, there was so much I didn't know. And you know what was so interesting? I started talking to parents and we were all like struggling. Everyone would tell me, I'm having this problem or that problem. And then I'd say, okay, well, will you be in my documentary? Can I just bring my camera and film? And of course, I didn't know this, but they all said no. And I realized how personal parenting is, that we can talk about kind of our struggles, but when it comes to like saying what our solutions are, we get embarrassed, I think, because we're worried we're going to be judged, that we're too strict, not strict enough. So people are really hungry for this information.
In order to tell my kids to limit their phone use, mm-hmm. don't I have to limit my phone use around them?
I think it's really important, of course.
Even though, of course, all my phone uses are highly important. And critical.
Exactly. Well, let's step back. I mean, a way that a family can address this is first and foremost having weekly discussions. No longer to have these reactive in the moment fighting, but to have, we call them Tech Talk Tuesdays, just once a week, a short amount of time, talking about why tech is fun, but also where we should have limits. And from there, then making a family agreement. And I think for parents, in terms of rules and setting, you know, finding times that tech should be off. And so that might be for many families like our own, not after bedtime to have it in the room or not to use it in the car. so you can have conversations in the car, or to put it away, the phone, while you're doing homework and just have tech breaks where you go and check it. Whatever those rules might be, it's also important as parents to, yes, to model, but also to say what we're struggling with. Because I think as parents, we also have times when we don't want to be on our devices. And when we share that with kids and we're not insecure about, hey, I'm trying to do better on this too, then the conversation becomes much more productive and inclusive as a group.
It sounds great. You've got it. It sounds fully formed from you. Sign a contract with your child. I mean, if you haven't done that, you might be pessimistic about this. How do I get this thing going from zero?
Well, first of all, I want to backtrack and say I'm still struggling with my daughter.
Okay.
It particularly a 14-year-old girl who would love to have her phone 24/7. We still talk about it and we still have tension-filled moments. Absolutely. Starting from zero, I think the first kind of conversation is really just an intake. How is technology working in everyone in the family's life? How much time are they on certain things? And how much time are they doing on other activities? Because that's really what when you get to a healthy amount of screen time, that's how you do it, is to figure out, are you doing any chores? Are you doing sports? And it's kind of shocking when you tally it up for a week. I think what was really heartbreaking for me is to see so many siblings tell me how they don't talk to their sibling anymore. One said, the only time I talk to my brother is when I knock on the door and say, when are you going to be out of the bathroom?
Yeah.
So the downside of not having these conversations and making it work in a more balanced way in our home is huge.
I'm interested in how you are releasing this film. You don't just want people to go out and sit in the theater or go to a film festival. You're licensing this movie for use in community settings. What's that about?
I really believe in the power of film to make social change. That's why I started it. And in all my documentaries, it's been about advocacy, making things better. And I think that screen time right now in our society is an issue all across the spectrum of where kids are spending time. Whether that's in a church setting, whether it's at their school, whether it's at their home, everywhere we're struggling with this. And I really wanted the film to be an instrument to bring all of these stakeholders together in community settings so that we can have the kind of discussions that's going to create, for example, healthy policies in school about tech time, healthy policies in our home. We can only do that if we take these tension-filled interactions we're having in schools and home out of the silos that they've been traditionally happening.
On KUOW Seattle, that is filmmaker and Dr. Delaney Rustin. She produced the movie Screenagers, directed it, put it together, and you can find some examples of smartphone contracts that other families have created at her documentary's website. Thanks for tuning in to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. More than 40% of transgender people have attempted suicide. More than 40%. That is 9 times the national average. But some new data out of the University of Washington suggests it does not have to be that way.
For a long time, I think people have thought of transgender people as kind of by definition having mental health challenges. And I think what's neat about following this new generation is that we don't have to have that assumption. And I think these data tell us that you can be happy, healthy, and happen to be transgender.
That's researcher Christina Olson, who runs the Trans Youth Project at the University of Washington. She is following this new generation, this group of transgender kids from across the United States as they grow up. And her research shows today's trans kids, whose families and schools support them in their gender identity early on, are just as happy as their peers.
these are kids who, you know, everyone around them calls them by that, by their new name, by their new gender. So they go to school and other kids think of them as a girl. They have a teacher who respects that gender identity. So this is, we're not just talking about, you know, a parent who allows their kid to wear a dress. We're talking about a kid who is embraced as a female in their life.
So when we talk about a supportive environment, an unsupportive environment, you're not talking about a cruel, mocking upbringing. You just mean the child lives in a home where the parents or the school are not recognizing the gender that the child sees.
Exactly, exactly. So in that sense, they're basically a kid who's not, a better way to think of it is a kid who's not socially transitioned, means that they're still going by the gender people assume them to have rather than the gender this child sees themselves as. And that would have been a much more common experience. You know, that would have been basically every child
yeah.
up till about 10 or 15 years ago would have had the experience of people saying, shh, you can't be, you're not a girl, you're a boy, you're just confused. What we're talking about in our study are kids who are allowed to live as their gender identity, and that gender identity isn't the thing people thought it was when they were born.
What did you find out about transgender kids who grow up like that?
What we find is that these kids have remarkably good mental health. So they have, I guess another way you could think of it is they have very average mental health. They look just like any other kid. So they have an equal amount of depression of just the average kid their age, but they have slightly higher anxiety. But what's important is that that's radically different than what we see in transgender teens or adults, and it's radically different than previous generations of gender nonconforming kids who hadn't socially transitioned. Those individuals tend to have very high rates of depression and anxiety, whereas our kids don't.
Do you think a common stereotype of transgender people has been, yeah, they have more anxiety, depression, suicide attempts, and that's linked to something that somehow there's something flawed about them to begin with?
Yeah, so that's really been the way that people have thought, especially about young kids who are what we've considered gender nonconforming. The thought has been, well, there's something wrong with these kids. This is itself a form of psychopathology. Or people have sort of thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the families that's causing the kids to be like this. And so the kind of dominant view has been, let's get these kids in therapy and let's fix them so that they don't end up identifying as transgender. And I think what this new approach that some of these parents are taking is really turning that on its head and saying, well, maybe it's the fact that these kids feel they have a gender that other people aren't believing that has caused these kind of depression and anxiety symptoms. And so that's why we're really interested in looking at those kids to see if we see reductions in depression and anxiety.
Well, Professor, we know that kids in general can be more resilient than adults. So how likely is it that these kids could manifest with mental health problems down the line?
That's exactly why we're going to follow these kids into the future to answer that question. I mean, life's not going to be perfect, right? I mean, it isn't for any teenager, but it might be particularly hard to be transgender, right? Issues like dating, puberty, all of these things are complicated. And some of these kids are, other kids don't know that they're transgender. If that comes out, you know, there's all sorts of things that could suggest they might have problems later. However, it's interesting to follow them nonetheless, because we might still expect that compared to peers who, for example, don't have family support or didn't have support early in life, that maybe these kids will be doing better. There's a lot of reason for optimism right now. You know, we've never had the kinds of visibility of the trans community. These kids are growing up in a culture in which there are people who are making a difference in the world that are public about their transgender identity. I think, you know, having role models out there must have such an impact. Think 20 years ago, you know, transgender kids back then wouldn't have had anything like that. And so I think that there is this possibility that these kids really, this is just a new generation that kids are thinking differently about gender than people of our generation and generations before us. So, yes, I think it will be hard. I don't think it's over by any means. I don't think having a parent accept you means it's suddenly going to be perfectly accepted to be transgender. But I think there's a lot of reason for optimism, and I'll be excited to see what the future holds for these kids.
Christina Olson directs the Trans Youth Project at the University of Washington. She's following a group of transgender youth from across America as they grow up. She's going to follow them for the next 20 years. And her newest findings show transgender kids who are supported in their gender identity at a young age are just as happy as other kids. But what does supporting your child's gender identity look like when the child is 4 or 5 years old? Tiffany Kelly and her son, Skylar, had to work that out together. They're one of the families taking part in Olson's study. Skylar is 9 years old now and was born a girl, but he knew when he was about 4 that he was supposed to be a boy. He just didn't know how to communicate that to his mom.
I never really told her. It went piece by piece. I never actually told her the real thing. She realized it herself.
She realized it herself, but that realization took a while. And Tiffany says she missed some of the signs.
What about when your hair was long and we'd have to fix it? Do you remember those times, how hard that was?
Yeah, always for a tantrum.
More than a tantrum, wouldn't you say?
I never bit you.
More like a meltdown. You were really miserable. What did you think during that time?
I don't really know. I just always felt like a boy. I don't know. I did not want to brush my hair.
Tiffany told me why it took her a while to recognize and accept that Skylar identified as a boy.
Unfortunately, I was mistakenly waiting for him to come right out and say, look, this is what I need. This is what I want. And finally, realizing that that was a lot to ask of a 4-year-old. The whole world's telling you a different thing, including your parents, but I'm waiting for you to tell me how you want to live.
When you started to realize, oh, Skylar's already thinking about being a boy, how clear or muddy was it to you at the time of what to do?
Still muddy. It was still really muddy because, my husband was still very much, you're overreacting. And he wasn't, and it wasn't in a, I won't be supportive, but it was just, I don't need to worry about being supportive because I don't think anything's going on here. And I knew something was.
Well, for one thing, I'm a parent. I don't always know how seriously to take something that my 5-year-old says.
Absolutely.
You could be making life decisions. You tell me about
that's a really good point because, because that's, of course, someone says, my 5-year-old says that they're a horse, and I'm not going to let them live as a horse. Well, first of all, when we were a year or two into this, you realize that a phase doesn't last a year or two. It's that consistent, persistent, insistent that we were seeing. But also, hey, what's so wrong about just accepting? Why do we have to argue these ideas out of our children's head? And, I know that Skylar is a boy, but if for some reason that hadn't been the case, I've done nothing worse than let my child know I love them no matter what.
Can you take me back to the moment? You must have had so many moments along the way, moments of realization. Does one come to mind?
Yes, absolutely. And I can, still clear as day picture where we were in the house. And Skylar was having, he would have these tantrums that weren't tantrums. They were meltdowns. And I kind of want to say the difference because it wasn't, I'm sure, people like to think, oh, it was just a child not getting their own way. But this was just unhappiness breaking through. I mean, someone that just couldn't really bear how unhappy they were. And it would happen around hairbrushing. And again, I just, slap my forehead of course, this long hair that you're forcing into, just as a reminder of something that's just miserable. But anyway, so it was one evening and it was just this meltdown. And I kept saying, Skylar, is there something wrong? And he just couldn't even contain the anger and sadness and misery. And we both, Josh, my husband and I, were saying, is there something you want to tell us? Or, what's wrong? We're trying to figure out what's going on. And he just couldn't even speak. And I finally said, just kind of out of desperation, do you want to whisper it in my ear? And he's, nodded yes. And I said, I promise there's nothing you can tell me that is, going to change how I feel about you. And he finally, and it was just, could tell it was so scary for him. And he whispered in my ear, I want to start wearing boys' underwear. And part of me was, okay, this is what we've been looking for, the sign. And relief, really. And so I said, you know, absolutely, I cannot buy them this moment, but I promise we will, you know, go tomorrow and we will do that. And I think it was because it was during the summer and before school starting, realizing I can't do another year living a fake life. And so that's when he told my mom, I want to start first grade and have people use, you know, he and him and be known as a boy. And we did that immediately. And the change was immediate. And that was really more telling. I mean, it was just night and day. It was, this is someone that is happy to be alive. And that's, I mean, I might have had questions and worries and everything up until then. And as soon as I saw the difference it made in him, my worries and fears were about the world, but not about what we were, the social transition, because it just gave me my child.
Tiffany, you're part of a study looking at the mental health of transgender kids who live in a supportive environment. What to you is a supportive environment?
The pronoun change, I think, is huge, and people don't realize that, you know, and I like to think...
Supportive is not just a matter of a nice home, but it's a very active thing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It starts with calling Scott or him.
Him and, you know, my son, and, you know, that was really important, and we were very, very lucky to have, you know, friends and family that immediately supported that. You know, we sent out a letter from the family, you know, basically explaining that we had made a mistake, that Skylar was not, in fact, a girl, and, you know, made it very clear that we understood that it might be something new or confusing for people. And we, you know, were very open to questions as long as they were brought with care and love. But what we were not accepting of is people that would not be willing to use he and him. That we would, you know, respectfully remove ourselves from their lives, because that's what I'm going to give Skylar. But I think also, and this is something I've learned and I'm still learning, I think that supportive is also realizing that, you know, we need to continue having the conversation that Skylar is a boy and Skylar is transgender, and he should be proud of his bravery and his truthfulness and his authenticity. And that's, you know, I talk to him about, you know, a lot of adults, we hide who we really are, and you should feel really, you know, good about that. And so I think that supportive is also, you know, continuing that conversation and not trying to, okay, now you've socially transitioned, we're done, we don't need to talk about it.
Why would you not talk about it? Why would that be a challenge?
You know, even Skylar would like to, you know, preferably, we're done. I'm a boy. I get to live like who I am now. So we're good. And my mom always, I quote this because I think it's really vital. And she said, you know, you're so busy trying to change, trying to prepare the world for Skylar. You need to make sure that you prepare Skylar for the world. And that's also really important to me that, you know, yes, we have been in this supportive bubble, but sadly, that's not the world. And we have a responsibility to try to make it better for everybody.
How do you know you're doing the right thing?
Because I see my child living. I mean, he's, you know, the turnaround in his personality was the first, this is the right thing. But living with him, I see Skylar and I see him happy as a boy. And that's, I guess, how I know. It's not a very concrete answer, but I can't imagine him any other way. And I also can remember how sad he was, and he's not anymore.
I can remember how sad he was, and he's not anymore. That's Tiffany Kelly. Her 9-year-old son, Skylar, is transgender. A University of Washington researcher is following Skylar and a group of trans kids around the country for the next 20 years. You can learn more about her work at KUOW.org with photos of Skylar. And we're tweeting out a link to Christina Olson's latest findings published in the journal Pediatrics. Follow us on Twitter at KUOW. The Second American Revolution. That is what young far-left radicals thought they were fighting in the late 1960s and early 70s when they started a movement to overthrow the U.S. government. They used bombings, kidnappings, assassinations, and bank robbery to spread their message. It's a period of time Brian Burrow calls the forgotten age of revolutionary violence. He writes about that time in his book Days of Rage. He follows the rise and fall of radical groups like the Weather Underground. And Burrow told KUOW's David Hyde that Seattle was an active secondary theater in the so-called Second American Revolution movement.
Early on, the Weather Underground was very active here in 69 and 70. In fact, the first ever book written by a Weather Underground alumna, Susan Stern, came out in 1974. She had been in Seattle. Unfortunately, they kind of blew up the Seattle apparatus here after 1970.
Not literally,
yeah. No, figuratively, as they kind of downsized after several reversals. And ultimately, Seattle became a place that a lot of Weather Underground people came to hide. People who had indicted that the FBI was after came to Seattle, came to Vancouver, especially those who needed to get out of the country.
What issues were they protesting in Seattle in particular?
Well, Seattle, of course, was... those in Seattle who were protesting were protesting the same things that everybody in the rest of the country was, primarily the war, but also civil rights. What made Seattle a little bit different is the rich history it has of labor organizing protests and violence. And so that history and kind of Seattle was such a hotbed of that type of organizing made it initially a magnet for Weather, and a number of its top organizers came from Seattle.
And you also write specifically about a man who was a Boeing machinist and a labor organizer. What's his story?
Clayton Van Lydegraaff was actually one of the oldest members, in fact, clearly the oldest member of the Weather Underground at a time where most of these young people were in their mid to early 20s. Clayton Van Lydegraaff was in his mid-50s. He had been active as a labor organizer and a radical in Seattle long before most of these kids had been born. When they came to Seattle to organize, he jumped on the bandwagon and was an avid and eager member of the San Francisco-based Weathermen. From 1970 through 1976, he was active in many of their major operations, including the escape from prison of the great LSD guru Timothy Leary. But perhaps his greatest contribution, Van Lydegraaff's greatest contribution to the Weather Underground, was its dissolution. It was at the end when Van Lydegraaff led an internal coup against Bill Ayers and the rest of the Weatherman leadership in 1976 that the Weather Underground began to come apart.
Why did he do that?
Because he believed, with quite frankly an awful lot of evidence behind him, that the Weather leadership had abandoned their ideals. They had gone underground in 1970 to launch a political revolution to empower the black underclass that they hoped would rise up with them. And none of that had happened. When other black militants had asked them, join our cause, the Weather Underground had decided not to, because it was by then eschewing murderous violence. Not to put too fine a point on it, the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army wanted to kill cops, and they killed quite a few. And by 1971, the Weather Underground decided they didn't want to do that anymore. And Clayton Van Lydegraaff was one of a minority in Weather that said, we've lost our way. We're not doing anything. We're sitting around, you know, smoking pot and talking about a revolution nobody's ever going to join. And Van Lydegraaff was one of the true believers from Seattle at the end, who was like, no, we're going to take this over and try to turn the clock back to 1968, to 1969, to 1970. And needless to say, he was as defeated in the end as they were. Van Lydegraaff and kind of his new reconstituted Weather Underground were all swiftly arrested.
How unusual was it for a 55-year-old man to get involved with this youth movement?
Well, it was unprecedented. If you look at all the groups that blew up things and shot people and robbed bank in the 1970s, there's really no precedent for a grandfather-aged guy to come in and kind of mentor these young people and to actually get involved in their political operations, if you will. Van Lydegraaff was a singular figure. He's largely forgotten because most of America doesn't pay a lot of attention to left-wing history. But in terms of the Weather Underground, he was a significant figure.
Brian Burrow's book is Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. What was the legacy of this age of revolutionary violence in Seattle, in American politics?
I've tried hard to identify a legacy. I've talked to a lot of people about it. If you look at politics, it's very difficult to find any legacy that these people have left behind on the American system. It just didn't happen. But if you want to look back on a societal, a practical legacy, look at bomb-sniffing dogs. Look at the security that we have now at corporate headquarters, at courtrooms, at city halls. That all began when the first bombs began going off in this country in 1970 and 1971. But that's really it in terms of a legacy. About all you can say is that for young radicals today, say those in the Occupy movement, there has certainly been a rediscovery of 70s and 60s era radicals, not because anyone wants to go back and embrace political violence as they did. Nobody wants to go back these days and blow up buildings or kill cops. But I think when they look back, when people today, young people especially, look back today at the radicals from the 1970s that did all this, they do find their commitment, their focus admirable, their zeal, and there are lessons to be learned there. And that was one of the reasons I wrote Days of Rage, not at all from a political vantage point. I have no politics. I just write straight history. I just wanted to reclaim this period because I felt like most of mainstream America had forgotten it. But it also turns out that there are people on the left and the right who want to rediscover it and take a very different set of lessons from it.
Well, and today we see the rise certainly of anti-government sentiment both on the left and on the right. How different is it from what you're writing about here from the early 1970s?
Well, it's night and day. I have gotten tons of questions since this book came out about how these groups compare to Black Lives Matter, to all the radical, if you want to say, all the organization that's happened over the last 18 months since Ferguson. And, I almost chuckle when I talk to when I watch the media talk about Baltimore going up in flames or this demonstration getting violent. This is nothing. Everything that's happened since Ferguson amounts to one good night in Watts in 1966. That's a good night in Newark in 1968. I think that young activists, young protesters today know their history. They know that there was a generation in the 60s and 70s that embraced political violence. And they know what that achieved, which is nothing.
Talking with KUOW's David Hyde, that's Brian Burrow, a Vanity Fair correspondent and author of this book, Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. And they were talking about Seattle's active part in all that here on KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in here 5 minutes before one. I'm Bill Radke. Why can't you afford to buy a home in Greater Seattle? Demand and supply. People keep coming here demanding new homes, and we're not supplying them. Why not? Here's Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill.
First of all, why are home builders not building as absolutely fast as they can right now?
Well, it's a complex set of circumstances growing out of the housing collapse. So if you look at the metro area, there are parts that are still oversupplied, say in Pierce County. In the city of Seattle, which is the most coveted place to be, there's only so much land, and a lot of it's zoned for single-family housing. A lot of neighborhoods don't want more density. The financing is a lot trickier to get nowadays for home builders.
Okay, so you mentioned a few things in there. For one, the urban growth boundary, right? We have rules that make it hard to grow outside of those boundaries. Is that a huge factor?
I don't think so. I mean, the urban growth boundaries are a good thing for ameliorating climate change and the effects of sprawl, even within the growth boundaries where they've built up around Woodinville. There's terrible traffic problems. So more exurban sprawl is not going to be the solution. The solution is going to be to find ways to build within the urban growth boundaries more density, and that doesn't necessarily mean 50-story high-rises.
Okay, well, then let's talk about that, more density. It occurs to me that rising prices are great if you already own your home. How much do you think influential homeowners are pressuring city leaders not to build more?
I think within the context of the power of the neighborhoods and especially district representation, there is pressure to preserve neighborhood character, and there's nothing wrong with that. On the other hand, you can have quality density a little bit more density in some areas. In transit areas, you can have a lot more density. For example, there's a great opportunity to build more density along the light rail south toward the airport.
So that has to do with building new homes. Meanwhile, there are also just aren't many existing homes on the market. Why are homeowners not selling now when prices are high?
They're not selling because they're afraid that they could not get enough money to then buy a new house in Seattle. And this is a fascinating piece of market failure. In other words, the market is not responding to the price points and saying, ah, let's build more houses for many of the reasons that I described. So that's why you have so little supply. Now, we have to remember that you go farther out, and there are places in South King County and Pierce County and Snohomish that have houses that are more affordable. What we need to do is get transit out there, fast, convenient transit with a build it fast so that we can get them to employment centers.
All right. Well, we do have transit coming to the ballot, although build it fast would not be the phrase that applies. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I still want to know about sellers. You say that they don't want to just get into a bidding war in the next home they're trying to buy. So if sellers thought prices were about to soften or fall, maybe they would all jump in at once and there go the dominoes?
Maybe. I mean, this is a very desirable place to be. So a lot of the sellers, potential sellers, want to be here anyway. Mm-hmm. And they might not put their houses on the market. But the biggest driving force for those who might potentially sell is that they can't then turn around and afford a new house.
So we've been talking about housing affordability and availability with John Talton from Seattle Times. Before we leave, John, I want to bounce a piece of news off you. The federal government has announced a $5 billion settlement with Goldman Sachs over the sale of mortgage-backed securities. These were the things that lit the fuse of the crisis because investors thought those mortgages were solid, the payments would keep coming, so they bought the mortgages, split them up, sold them down the line, and that's how it got to be a big system-wide crisis, right? What's your take on a $5 billion settlement with Goldman Sachs?
Cost of doing business. They got away with it. Nobody went to prison. This only enhances moral hazard, which means that the banksters know that the next time they gamble and take on excessive risk and blow up the economy, that the taxpayers will bail them out. This is a classic example of socializing risk and privatizing profits. It's a shameful thing.
Heads we win, tails you lose.
Exactly.
John Talton, not a happy ending, but a real one. Economics columnist with Seattle Times. Always good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
We're live tweeting here at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Engineer Bernard Ouellette, producer Jason Pagano. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in to The Record.